Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're here every Wednesday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, agents, those connected with the art or the business of writing. Tonight, I have in the studio mystery author Earlene Fowler. Welcome, Earlene. Earlene is the author of five mysteries featuring Private Eye Benny Harper, ex-cowgirl of San Salina. Earlene Fowler was raised in La Puente by a southern mother and a western father. She lives in Orange County with her husband, Alan, and a large number of quilts and 20 pairs of cowboy boots. Tell me how you got started writing. I've known of Earlene for so long, and I've never actually talked with
you. Well, thank you for having me here, Barbara. Well, actually, I was not one of those people that grew up wanting to be a writer, which I'm being in the industry like I have and hearing so many writers talk, I'm beginning to find out is pretty unusual. I never even thought about being a writer until I was in my late 20s. And at the time, I started taking some classes at night at my local junior college. At the time, I lived in Azusa, California. And I was taking quilting classes and different craft classes. And one of the classes I took was a creative writing class. And I really enjoyed it. I started by writing short stories. And for 10 years, I wrote short stories that I mailed out to various magazines and had absolutely no success in getting published. As a matter of fact, in the 10 years that I wrote, the only encouragement I really got was one literary magazine that I sent a story to. The editor wrote nice moments on the printed rejection slip.
And you claimed
I had no idea what moments was nice, but that was a real encouragement to me, which I needed at the time. During the 10 years, a lot of times I quit writing, and that was when I got involved with crafts like quilting and basket making and different things like that. When I was in my late 20s, by that time I was living in Orange County, and at that time I had probably taken 10 or 11 creative writing classes at different junior colleges in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And I decided to take a class at Orange Coast College, a novel writing workshop. And the first one I took, I wrote the first chapter of Fool's Puzzle, which at the time was called Drunkard's Path. And it wasn't a very good chapter, but I took the class. It was from a local teacher here called Raymond Obsfeld. And then he went on a sabbatical for, I think, a year, and there was a sabbatical replacement teacher. And I took that class also. It was also a novel writing workshop, and it was taught by a local author that a lot of people know, Joanne Mapson. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I had finished. I had gone back and rewritten my first chapter of what was to become Fool's Puzzle about 25 times. And
you rewrote it 25 times?
I rewrote it 25 times. I find that creative writing classes are really great because you get a lot of feedback from a lot of different people. And there's probably about 30 people in that class, and a lot of the suggestions I got were good. And I studied writing at the time just by reading how-to books and stuff. By the time I took Joanne's class, I was finished with all but the last two chapters. And I turned in my first chapter again, which is the rewritten first chapter. And she liked it and asked me if she could read the whole book when the book was finished. So I took about another month and a half to finish writing the book. Then she read it, offered a few suggestions, and helped me write up a query letter, which we sent to her agent. She had talked to her agent about me before then. And we sent it to her agent back in New York. And at that time, I didn't, again, being so naive and not knowing anything about the publishing world, because I knew absolutely, Joanne was the first published writer I'd ever known. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that being accepted by an agent so quickly was very unusual. And so her agent liked the book and accepted it. And when I talked to her on the phone, she said, now don't get too excited because it's very difficult for a new mystery writer to get published, and just it might take 6 months to a year. Well, about a week later, she called me back and said that she had sold that book plus two others to Putnam Berkeley, which is now Penguin Putnam. So in the course of a week, I became a published author.
So what did you do with this?
Well, I can remember that I heard the news when I was in my kitchen wearing my bathrobe. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and my agent had had the manuscript for about a week. And at that point, I was still so new at this that I had difficulty even saying my agent. That sounded so funny to me, you know. It sounded so Hollywood. And she called me and told me the news, and I just stood there. I didn't know what to do. And finally, I asked her, what do I do now? And she said, start your next book. Mm-hmm. So that's just what I've been doing ever since.
Now, how many times did you actually rewrite the book?
Well, I rewrite as I go along. Mm-hmm. That's kind of has been my way of doing things. Whenever I talk to writing classes or new writers about how to write novels, and they always ask me, do you outline, do you do this? And one thing I always try to emphasize is that everybody has their own way of writing a novel. And my way happens to be that I rewrite as I'm writing the first draft. That's why it takes me about 9 months to write my first draft, because I'm also rewriting. Right now I'm about page 140 in the novel I'm working on now, and I've been working on it for about 4 months. But I've probably rewritten the first chapter already 10 times. Sometimes when I get stuck in a place, what I'll do is I'll go back and rewrite what I already have. And it helps me think about where it is that I want to go.
By the time you reach the end of the book, do you start over, and is your first chapter completely different from, say, what it was when you originally started the book?
Usually it's not a lot different, because the one thing I've found common with all of my books is that I have a good idea of where I want the book to start and a good idea of where I want it to end. It's the middle part that's always a bit hazy, because that's where most of the plot is.
Right.
And where I think the beginnings and endings of books, at least my books, tend to focus on character. And I know my characters so well that I always know kind of where I want them to be toward the end and at the beginning. But the rewriting, a lot of it that I do is because I change things. That's how come I don't really like people to read my work in progress. That's something I started right from the beginning. I've never belonged to a writer's group except for a very short period of time, because I found that people reading my works in progress stunt me. Because in this book, the reason it's taken me so long to get to page 140 is because I've changed the murder scene 3 times already and changed the person who was a murderer 3 times. So if someone had read the first draft and the second draft, you know, I don't even let my editor do that, because I'm afraid she'll fall in love with one of the first or second drafts, and that might not be the one that I want to do.
Now, quilting is a part of every book.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, like I said, during the time that I would quit writing, when I would get discouraged during those 10 years, I spent a lot of time doing folk crafts. Folk crafts really appeal to me because I come from a blue-collar background. And so most of the people that raised me and I grew up around were not people who had a lot of education. That's not to say they weren't artistic and they weren't talented, but people who have to work for a living, when they want to express themselves artistically, tend to go toward the folk crafts, because it's a type of art that I think really comes from your soul, because you don't have like all the rules that you learn when you go to school and you learn all the fine arts. Well, that always appealed to me, so that's what I would do. Obviously, I had this creativity that was struggling to come out, and sometimes with the writing it couldn't. So I would turn to quilting and different types of crafts. And quilting really appealed to me simply because it wasn't an art form that started out, one, as primarily being women that were involved in it, although that's rapidly changing now that it's a $1 billion-a-year business. Men are getting involved in it now. And also because it is an art form that my grandmother was involved with, and my aunts and different people in my family, because they grew up, my grandmother was a sharecropper on one side and my other grandmother was a migrant worker. So this was the type of way that they expressed their creativity, and so that appealed to me.
And the titles all have something to do with quilting.
The titles of my books are all quilt patterns. I have a book that is 4,000 quilt patterns. And so the titles, one thing about the titles is that they are so evocative to me. When you listen to the titles of books of quilts like Broken Dishes, that was the very first one that appealed to me as being the title of a book. I still haven't written that book yet, and someday I want to. But the different titles, like the book I have coming out in May called Mariner's Compass, there's this, the title or the pattern of the quilt seems to actually suggest a story.
And where did you get the title from? From the book, but why did you choose this title for the current book?
Mariner's Compass?
No, the one you're...
Oh, the one that just is out now that I'm going to read from is called Dove in the Window. And it appealed to me because in the book, one of the main characters is my protagonist, Benny Harper, is her grandmother, and her grandmother's name is Dove. So I knew eventually I would have to use the pattern Dove in the Window just simply because of the name.
Did you name her after this pattern, knowing that you'd use it someday?
No, actually, Dove just came to me, and I don't know where the name came from. It was just, she was one of those characters, and any writer will tell you, you have some characters that you really have to struggle with to create, and you have some that just sort of pop on the scene, they name themselves, and they're just there, you know, completely right from the beginning. And her grandmother, Dove, was like that.
Interesting. Will you read a couple of pages?
Sure. What I'm going to be reading is the first 6 pages of the novel. "You sold me," Elvia shrieked. She slapped her teacup down into the saucer. "Like one of your cows?" I swear one of my kitchen windows rattled. My ever-supportive husband's deep and melodious laugh reverberated from the living room of our tiny Spanish-style bungalow. No doubt a smug "I told you so" from a certain chief of police resided in my immediate future. I held my hands palms out in entreaty to my best friend since second grade. Try and think of it as a short-term lease. Then I darted out of her reach, placing my sturdy pine kitchen table between us. "Vinny Harper, I'm going to kill you," she said. Her black eyes flashed, and it occurred to me that repressed in her genetic memory might lurk some incredibly painful means to accomplish that task. Was it the Spanish conquistadors or Native Americans who smeared their enemies' naked bodies with honey and tied them to anthills? Well, what she didn't recall genetically, she'd make up for with torture techniques she'd learned being the only female sibling among six males. "It's just one night," I said, contemplating the distance to the knife drawer. I ran faster than she did in grade school. Could my 35-year-old legs still beat her? "A few hours. You'll like him." I gave an encouraging smile. "Besides, as your own dear mama has often said, you're getting kind of old. You really should consider Emery. He's very handsome. You'd make beautiful babies." She glared at me. "He's a geek." "Geek? No one uses that word anymore. And besides, the last time you saw him, he was 11 years old. He's 34 now, all grown up. Elvia, I had to offer him something. It was for a good cause. The information he found for me helped solve two murders." She sipped her Earl Grey tea and continued giving me the evil eye. I considered telling her how attractive she looks when she's angry, then decided that was pushing my luck. My best friend, Elvia Aragon, was really a breathtakingly beautiful woman, a combination of Armani elegance and Latina sensuality wrapped up in a perfect size 3. She's smart, too, and law-abiding. I was hoping that last trait would not be compromised by my small but audacious act, because I had indeed sold her lock, stock, and Charles Jordan pumps to one Emery Delano Littleton of Sugar Tree, Arkansas. Well, at least her services for one night. A date, that's all. Kiss not included, unless Emery could weasel one out of her, which I wouldn't put past him. He's got a real way about him, old Emery does. Emery is my cousin, sort of, in that weird meandering way only Southerners truly understand. His grandfather and my dad's grandfather were first cousins by marriage, and to make the connection even more complex, Emery's father, Boone Emery Littleton, famous all over northeastern Arkansas for his smoked chicken company, Boone's Good Eatin' Chicken, married my mother's third cousin, Irvaline, after they met at my mother and father's wedding. Cousin Irvaline died when Emery was 11, and Emery stayed that summer at our ranch outside San Salina, on the central coast of California, while his father closed every bar in Little Rock. After 3 months of trying to drown his sorrow in innumerable bottles of expensive Kentucky bourbon, Boone was saved at a tent revival and called Emery back home. I'd seen my cousin since on my occasional trips back to Arkansas with my Grandma Dove to visit her sister Garnet, but he's never returned to California, mostly because he's afraid to fly. That's why I felt safe offering Elvia's services when I needed Emery to use his extensive and often suspiciously gained journalistic contacts through the South to help me with a couple of murder investigations I'd stumbled into. He'd had a crush on Elvia since he first set his green southern eyes on her that summer 23 years ago. Even at 12, Elvia was turning men's brains to mush. "Emery's changed a lot since he was 11," I said, setting a plate of her favorite almond scones from Stern's Bakery in front of her. "And he really did help me. Think of it as a public service." I'd been rehearsing this talk for 2 weeks, ever since getting the phone call from Emery, informing me he was joining the Ramsey clan for Thanksgiving at the ranch this year. His train would arrive at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, which was today. "Nevertheless, I'm going to kill you," she said, her voice determined. Only someone who knew her as well as me would hear the tinge of resignation in her tone. I released my held breath, knowing I'd won. But I'd owe her big for this favor, and she wouldn't hesitate calling it in when it was to her greatest advantage. Knowing when to fight and when to temporarily concede was one of the traits that had turned her bookstore and coffee house, Blind Harry's, into one of the most powerful independent bookstores in California. "Is it safe to re-enter the arena?" Gabe stuck his head around the corner of the kitchen door, his deep-set, gray-blue eyes inquiring behind round, gold-rimmed glasses. You'd think someone who had been a cocky Marine grunt in Vietnam, a fearless undercover narcotics cop in East L.A., and was currently San Salinas' chief of police, would behave a little less like the Wizard of Oz's cowardly lion. That conveys a bit of the power of Elvia's personality. He said something to Elvia in Spanish that made her red lips part into a tiny, reluctant smile. "No fair," I said. "Speak English." "Don't worry," Elvia told him. "I'll wait until you leave before murdering her. Then you can send one of your underlings to investigate." He entered the kitchen, tying his conservative gray and blue silk tie. Good. I've got enough to worry about with all the San Celina Heritage Day security. Try and make it neat. I don't have time to mop the floor this week. He leaned over and kissed me, then rubbed his 5-day growth of black and silver beard across my cheek. Combined with his gray Brooks Brothers suit and white dress shirt, the beard looked incongruous and a bit sexy. Just a slight deviation from what I call his Sergeant Friday look. Ouch, I said, pushing him away. You're packing a lethal weapon there. You're the one who talked me into entering this ridiculous beard-growing contest, so you'll have to suffer, too. He scratched his face vigorously with his knuckles. So when does the big date ensue? Alvy and I spoke at the same time. Never, she said. This week, I said. Gabe laughed out loud. Please, I begged her. I'll hand-wash and wax your precious Austin Healy. I'll work at the bookstore during the next Christmas seasons. I'll pick every flea out of Sweet William's coat with tweezers. Sweet William was her newly inherited championship Persian cat. She stood up and picked up her leather briefcase. Sweet William has never had a flea in his life. You owe me mucho grande, gringa loca. Grand Canyon big. Pavarotti big. A bigness of global proportions. I scooted around the table and hugged her. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You are the queen of best friends. He'll behave himself, I promise. I hope was what I was actually thinking. Are you coming to the barbecue on Friday afternoon? Every year since I can remember, my dad, the oldest of the 6 Ramsey kids, and his mother, my Grandma Dove, have hosted a barbecue at the Ramsey Ranch the day after Thanksgiving for all our friends and family. It coincided with our 4-day, no-holds-barred, kick-em-in-the-nuts-when-they're-down poker tournament and semi-annual calf roundup. California's Central Coast, having the mildest weather around, didn't have to adhere to the traditional spring roundup common in colder states. And besides, Daddy always liked to get a head start on castrating our calves before they grew too big. To keep his young ranch hands happy, though, he always saved some for the spring so that we could have an old-fashioned roundup complete with roping and riding and Rocky Mountain oysters. But every November, my uncles and aunts left their ranches and came from all over the West to participate in this Thanksgiving ritual of food, cards, and cattle. For 4 days, the ranch looked like a cross between a scout camp, small-town rodeo, and a 2-star RV park. I didn't attend last year because I couldn't endure the family crowd after losing my husband Jack the February before in an auto accident. But it had been almost 2 years since Jack was killed, and this year I was attending with Gabriel Ortiz, my new husband, a complex and wonderful gift from God that with more than a little amusement, I imagine, dropped into my life when I least expected it. Elvia pushed me away, straightening her cinnamon-colored Armani knit suit. Don't try to make up to me. And yes, the whole Aragon clan will be there. We haven't missed one in 28 years, have we? She patted her black hair, arranged this morning in an elegant French twist. Just keep Emery away from me. I'll agree to a short dinner on the day of my choosing. That's it. I don't want him pawing all over me at the barbecue. She pointed at the scones. I've got things to do. Wrap mine up to go. Yes, ma'am, I said, pulling a plastic bag from the drawer. I promised to keep him occupied. You might be surprised, though. He's quite a personable man now. I held out the wrapped scones, giving her a wide smile. He's from Arkansas, she said with a disdainful sniff. She grabbed the bag and stuck it in her briefcase. Tell Dove happy Thanksgiving for me. See you Friday. Mama's bringing tamales. Bless her, Gabe said with a sigh. She scowled at him. You know, I actually thought you might be able to control her. Better people than me have tried and failed, he said, unperturbed. Boy, I said, pouring myself another cup of coffee after she left. That was close. I thought she was going to leave me flapping in the breeze. She should have, he said, reaching into the Stern's bakery bag and pulling out a cranberry scone. It really was presumptuous of you. So you've told me a few hundred times, but it worked. A female general I saw interviewed on television one time said it's easier sometimes to ask forgiveness than permission, or something like that. That could be your motto, he said, his voice not a little ironic. Take your scones and go to work, Chief Ortiz, I said, kissing him goodbye, before crime overtakes the fair streets of San Celina.
Thank you, Arlene. If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to Arlene Fowler read from Dove in the Window, her 5th book. I'm curious, how much of this do you outline?
I don't outline very much, actually. Like I said, I know the beginning of the book and the ending, and I know some key scenes during a book. And so a lot of times what will happen when I'm in the middle of the book is I'll have to go back up to the Central Coast, or like in the case of my 3rd book, I had to fly back to Kansas and sort of let things happen to me so I get ideas.
So has it always been this way? Did you start out not outlining a whole lot and just coming up with sort of the beginning and ending and a few few points.
Right, yeah, I've never outlined. I never, because it changes so many times, like the book I'm working on now, so much changes because something will happen to me in the middle of writing a book and it'll be something great and I'll want to put it in there. And so if I had an outline, I think, I'm a very organized person, and I think if I did outline, I would feel compelled to stick with it. Mm-hmm. So it actually is good for me not to outline because I think it would stunt my creativity.
Do you have readers along the way? People that you give the manuscript to as it's in progress?
No, I don't let, that's one thing right from the beginning, even with my editor. I can't let someone read my manuscript as I'm writing it because, like I said, I change things, I add things. What I do is I finish the first draft, which is technically probably more like the seventh or eighth because I've done so much rewriting as I'm writing it, in about 9 or 10 months. And then I have two people that I have read it. My husband, who I do read scenes to as I'm writing them. If I'm really excited about a scene and I absolutely have to have a human being hear it, I'll read him a scene out loud. And then my friend Joanne, her and I exchange manuscripts. And then by after those two people read it, I have a new person who's just started reading my books who is not a writer, which is actually gives you a different view. With my first couple of books, it was my sister. She was a mystery reader. And now I have somebody else. So it's kind of three people I have before I send it to my editor.
While you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that you said you weren't in a writing group. And is it because there's too many people giving feedback, or what is it about?
Well, all the classes I took were 18-week creative writing courses. And I actually, for me, that's the ideal way of doing it because you get, I think, a more unprejudiced critique because these people don't really care about you and they're most like the readers that you would have out in the real world. I was in a writing group for about 6 months after I published my first book. It was one that a friend of mine encouraged me to get into. And I loved the people in the group. They were wonderful people. But I found that it was really hard for me to go every week and have someone read what I was writing and critique it. Now, I know lots of writers that have written every book all the way through their career that way. For me, it just didn't work. I think because I get too confused with people telling me, you know, what they think as I'm writing it, especially when I would maybe have to go back the next week and say, oh, everything that I had you read, you know, for the last 2 months, I've tossed it. Yeah. So, and also, I think sometimes with writing groups, I've had this happen to a lot of friends of mine, when you're in a writing group for too long, you almost become too close. You're like relatives almost, and you learn each other's problems and all that, and that makes it hard for you to critique, honestly.
Sure.
Because, you know that maybe they're writing that part, and it's not as good as it could be because they're having a tough time at work or whatever, and so you tend to hold back on your critique.
You said when you first started writing short stories, they were literary short stories. How did you start writing a mystery series?
Well, I've probably written about 150 literary short stories. And like I said, at the time, I didn't really realize how hard it is to break into the writing market. I didn't know anything about publishing. I realized after a while that to get published in the literary world, you really need to, you know, go to school, get the MFA in creative writing, make the connections. It's a very closed society. It truly is. And to get published in it, you would just have to be maybe just extremely brilliant, which I wasn't. So I went one time to a thing at South Coast Plaza where they had, it was a literary day, and they had 8 mystery writers speak. And I remember that Gar Anthony Haywood, I think, was one of them, and Wendy Hornsby was another. And it was at a really odd time. It was like at noon. So that there
was under stairs.
And there was hardly anybody in the audience. I think I was the only person who sat through all 8 speeches. And what struck me is that they all were such normal people who had normal jobs. And I thought, well, maybe this is an area. I'd always read mysteries, but it never occurred to me to write one, mostly because I'm not plot-oriented, and which is one of the things that mystery reviewers get after me a lot. One of the things my fans love the most about my books is they aren't plot-oriented. I would say a good 50% of my fans are not mystery readers. But the reviewers really get me because plot is not as important to me. But I thought it would be maybe a place that was more open to the general public, so to speak. And I was right. It was.
What advice do you have for writers who are starting out and struggling through their manuscript?
I would say, and I see this so much, that you really need to learn your craft. And I know that a lot of writers hear that, but I go to so many classes, I talk to so many classes, I teach at conferences, and talk to so many writers in the last 7 years that I've been published, and it just amazes me that people have the idea that when they write something once, they write one book or they write 5 short stories, that somehow that they deserve to be published. And they don't understand how much work it takes to learn your craft before you can even get to the part with the art. Mm-hmm. My story sort of is I always try to emphasize to people, even though I got my first novel published, the first novel I ever wrote, I wrote 150 short stories that were rejected before I got to that point.
Perseverance.
And it's because I love the craft of writing. And mm-hmm. I find that a lot of writers out there, a lot of aspiring writers, are more in love with the idea of being an author than they are in love with the idea of finding that right word, mm-hmm. creating that right sentence. And I would say, study your craft. You don't have to know somebody. Too many people spend too much time thinking about, how do I learn how to schmooze? How do I meet the right people? How do I... When, if you write a really good manuscript, it's going to show. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot more bad manuscripts out there than there are good.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Barbara.
You've been listening to me, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and talk with Earlene Fowler. Her fifth book is called Dove in the Window. Are you giving any signings coming up?
No, I'm basically done with all my signings. The book came out in May, and I've been promoting for about 3 months. So now I'm heavy into writing my seventh book.
So your sixth one will be out?
My sixth book in May of 98. It's called Mariner's Compass.
A little less than a year from now. Wonderful. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And join us next week when Debbie Bull, author of Blue Jelly, will be my guest. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you need to reach me, you can fax me at 760-1443. Stay tuned for On Air, Off Air with Chris. Thanks for listening, and get to work. And remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.